My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I do regret that our new building isn't up with the 250-seat auditorium so that you'd all be a lot more comfortable. But it will be there soon, 2.5 years. If anybody has a vacant seat next to them, please raise your hand, because we would like to fill in as much as possible. We are missing Rich Williamson for the moment, which is unfortunate, but I think given the discomfort in which everybody is, we should go ahead and start anyway. I think it's my job only to ask you to turn off your cell phones, to fill in, if people get up to leave, to fill in those seats as rapidly as you can. And let me turn the occasion over to our colleague from CSIS, with whom we're co-sponsoring this event, Steve Morrison, who will introduce the speakers. Steve.
Thank you. Welcome, all. We at CSIS have building envy looking at this project that is unfolding, groundbreaking. It was last week, I believe, which is an amazing moment. And as of 2013, we will be in a building in this neighborhood just around the corner. So we're all busy trying to overcome the constraints of buildings that no longer fit what we do programmatically. We're very grateful for the chance to be here co-hosting this very important event here. I think we are very fortunate in having such an amazing collection of expertise here today to talk about this pressing matter of the CPA, the recent crisis surrounding ABA, the recent efforts to bring the pieces back together and come up with a renewed roadmap for averting crisis and moving things forward. It's a complex agreement. I think we're very, very blessed today to have the people that are here with us to sort of give us some insights into this process and what lies ahead. I've asked Alex Duvall, if he could open up with some remarks, 10 or 12 minutes of remarks. When Rich comes here, we will move from Alex to Rich and then to Vanessa and to Andrew Natsios. Alex has been working on Sudan now, when we were chatting earlier today, and trying to tabulate the number of years, a good 25 years on Sudan. He lived in Darfur for, I think it was a total of 3 years in the 80s, doing his doctoral research, which was a groundbreaking work looking at the coping mechanisms around famine in Darfur, and it gave him really an extraordinary set of insights into Darfur that live with him today. He's been one of the world's leading experts on the Horn of Africa for the last two decades. He's just recently published an updated version of the book that he and Julie Flint have put out, A New History of a Long War, which has just come out, which Macmillan will be publishing and distributing here in the United States. I urge you all to look at that. Hi, Rich. We're going to change course.
No.
We'll let Alex come and begin. So Alex is going to kick this off, and then he'll be followed by Rich Williamson. Rich became the president's envoy, special envoy on Sudan, in early January of this year. He's a practicing partner in the Chicago law firm of Winston and Strawn. He's had
take
a
more business. Feel free.
He's had a very distinguished career in diplomacy, stretching back to the Reagan and earlier Bush administrations. He was in the first, or earlier in this decade, ambassador of the United Nations for Special Political Affairs, and ambassador of the UN Commission on Human Rights. Previous to that, was assistant secretary for international organizations at the Department of State and a special assistant to the president on intergovernmental affairs. He was very integral to this most recent set of deliberations on ABA, and we're grateful that he's here to offer us insights into that. Let me quickly introduce Andrew and Vanessa before we turn to Alex to kick this off. Andrew Natsios, since January of 2006, has been the a professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown from late 06 through the end of last year. He was a special envoy on Sudan and was very passionate and very active in that role. He's just recently published a terrific piece in Foreign Affairs on Sudan, which I would urge all of you to read if you haven't had the chance to see that. He served from 2001 to 2006 as the administrator of USAID and oversaw many many major changes in the way AID has done its business, and he's done many other things over the course of his career. He has been remarkably influential in the contributions that he's made on the Horn of Africa and broader humanitarian efforts, in particular with a special reference to Sudan going back to the early 90s. Vanessa Jimenez is with us today. She's a senior peace fellow with the Public International Law and Policy Group, which is a very interesting organization. It's a sort of virtual global pro bono international legal outfit which provides pro bono assistance to different clients who are engaged in peace implementation efforts. In this case, the government of Southern Sudan is the client. This relationship was struck 2 years ago. She brings vast wealth of experience drawing on the Middle East and Balkans and other areas, has recently published a very fine piece seeking solutions to the crisis in Abyei. So, with that, welcome. Thank you all. Alex, why don't you kick this off?
Thank you very much, Steve. And I'm really the warm-up act, so I'll be fairly brief and to the point. I was just reflecting that it is actually 25 years since I started working on Sudan, and one of the most remarkable things about Sudan is every time I go there, there's a lot happening. I meet the new diplomats who've just been seconded and arrived in Khartoum, and they say, there's this reshuffle happening, there's this new opportunity happening, and there's always movement. It's not like some parts of the Middle East where things move at a glacial pace. And yet, 25 years on, very little has actually changed. And it's actually I would characterize it as a very turbulent system. It's always full of noise and change, but fundamentally remains the same. And of course, it's a system that produces immense bloodshed, human carnage, and distress throughout very large parts of the country. And I've puzzled for some years about why it might be that Sudan is such a dysfunctional nation for many of its citizens. And yet, how is it that this is a country that doesn't collapse altogether? How is it that the government manages to remain in power? And this government is almost 19 years in power, having caused more mayhem and misery even than its predecessors. And yet it's there, and it's about to, if things go according to the plan that the leaders of the NCP have in mind, it will be reincarnated at the head of a broader coalition, bringing in the man they overthrew, Sadiq al-Mahdi, into a broad northern coalition in advance of the elections. How do they manage to do this? Through my career, I've sort of tried various hypotheses, like these are Machiavellian evil geniuses in Khartoum and so on, and none of these really held much water. I was at the Darfur peace talks in Abuja, and I had the opportunity to observe at very close quarters for very extended periods of time one of the most powerful figures in the Sudan government, Dr. Majzoub al-Khalifa. He died a year ago in a car crash, but then in life he was one of the key people in the regime. And it was very interesting to watch how he operated, because I started off intensely disliking and rather despising the man, but I ended up with a sneaking admiration for how he managed the system. And I think we should sort of put aside take off our moral clothes and say, actually, how does this work? Let's understand how this system actually functions and stays intact. And then, later on we can come to moral and political judgments about what to do, whether we like it or not. Most probably we don't. And for Majzoub, this sort of big, rather reptilian figure, I called him a king crocodile in an article that I wrote. And actually, I was a bit worried meeting him afterwards that he would be offended. I think he was rather pleased by that, actually. And funnily enough, actually, when after his death, the presidency published some tributes to him, a little booklet, and they translated what I thought were my rather uncomplimentary remarks about him, including the king crocodile, the reptilian analogy, and put it actually in that little booklet. I think the phrase that actually they liked was that I said he was as vexatious to his allies as he was fearsome to his foes. And he had as many enemies within that ruling circle as he did as he did outside. But the real skill of Majzub was not his obstreperousness, was not his incredibly thick skin. It was the fact that he was a master of the political marketplace. His job at the peace talks was not to get a deal, a formal deal on the table. His job was to work out what was the price of every single delegate from the rebel side, and indeed many from his own side, and pay absolutely at the minimum. He was, as the Sudanese say, a jalaba politician, a mercantile operator. And I think if we begin to analyze Sudan as a political marketplace, we can see that it has operated in this way since the mid-19th century. In the mid-19th century, people were commodities. They no longer are, most of the time. But the chief challenge of those in power is to try and drive down the price of loyalty, to try and make it as cheap as possible to buy up the loyalty of the central elites and the provincial elites. And the provincial elites play this game, and we saw them playing this game in Abuja and elsewhere, trying to drive up the price of loyalty, trying to get the best possible price. And they were aided in this in Abuja by the entry of Chad and Libya and indeed the international community into the market. If they're more buyers, the laws of supply and demand say that the price that you will have to pay in terms of money and guns to get the loyalty of Abdul Wahid al-Nur or Khalil Ibrahim or the Janjaweed commanders will go up. And one sees these sorts of maneuvers going on all the time. We see, for example, you know, the most infamous Janjaweed commanders defecting to the other side, holding out for a higher price, fighting the government. One day they're shouting, you know, we will cleanse Darfur of the black African tribes. Next then we have this on tape. You know, that Mohammed Hamdan Hemeti, the most powerful Arab militia leader in Darfur, is saying, we will fight Khartoum till Judgment Day. This ideology is very opportunistic, I think, in the service of driving up the price of loyalty. In the case of Hemeti, he fought the government for 4 months. Killed a couple of hundred troops, shot down a couple of helicopters, had his brother killed, and then went back to the government for a much higher price than the one before, including the price that he would choose his own operations that he went on. So he was maintaining good relations with his non-Arab neighbors as a result of that. And the Darfur rebels play exactly the same game. At the end of the day, what broke the deal in Abuja was that the money on the table was simply not enough for Abdul Wahid. Or the personal money, that is. Now, what's interesting is if you analyze Sudan really as a political marketplace, the biggest buyer is Khartoum. And for most of the time, the challenge of Khartoum is to buy in as many people as it can. Now, what generates violence in the system is when there isn't enough money for them to buy in everybody, or their alternative buyers coming into the marketplace, like Chad, like Libya, or the provincial elites want to make a point, want to drive up the price, and this is what we see with the recurrent insurrections, and then the government overreacts, tries to crush them, and kills large numbers of people, on a sort of fairly cyclical basis. What's interesting is that if one looks at Juba, the government of South Sudan, it's actually playing much the same strategy. Juba is also trying to buy loyalty. It's spending more than $500 million a year on its defense forces, basically by distributing rewards to militia commanders. That's the core of its defense strategy as it is at the moment. Now, where this analysis leads us, I think, is really to the economic core of what holds Sudan together or drives it apart. And what I think is holding it together, and we'll hear more about BA in a moment, is oil. Because oil can be extracted on a collaborative basis. What we see is, you know, either side could turn off the oil, but then they will both suffer. So there is a powerful incentive for them to cooperate over oil, up to a point, because the North, in principle at least, has the option of just controlling the oil fields and letting the rest of the country go hang. And yet there is also the challenge that, politically speaking, there is no consensus around the sort of centralization of patrimonialism that that would entail. So I would see I would reconceptualize the core challenge of Sudan as how one squares the challenge of a centralizing sort of patrimonial system based upon oil, based upon the division of oil, with the fact that it is a politically very, very polarized country, with the Darfurians moving away from the center, particularly in the aftermath of the abortive coup attempt by Khalil Ibrahim of the Justice and Equality Movement, a large proportion of the southern elites being pro-independence. How is this the political drive towards fragmentation to be squared with the economic drive towards centralization? And I think this is the most profound medium-term policy challenge that we face. I will leave it at that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. First, I want to thank USIP and CSIS for helping host this. It's good to be back at USIP, where I serve on the advisory board and a great friend and supporter of the President, Dick Solomon, with whom I worked in the State Department, former Chairman Chet Crocker and others. Also want to thank Jim Morrison for his monitoring it today. It's good to see Ezekiel, who helps represent the SPLM here, and Ambassador Ukek represents government of Sudan here in Washington. Andrew Natsios and Alex DeWall have probably forgotten more about Sudan than I'll ever know, so they'll critique and criticize and add to what I have to say, but I'm glad that they're here and I've benefited from their experience and their writings. Because, and also let me say that in 2005 I was asked to be here on a panel with Francis Deng and Chet Crocker on Darfur, and this room was about two-thirds full, so it says something about the growing interest in Sudan, which I think is a good thing. Sudan is enormously complex, and let me just read from Douglas Johnson's The Root Causes of the Sudan's Civil War, because I think it touches on some of the elements we have to keep in mind and that Alex has referred to. The Sudan entered the 21st century mired in not one but many civil wars. What had been seen in the 1980s as a war between North and South, Muslim against Christian, Arab against African, has, after nearly two decades of hostilities, broken the bounds of any North-South conflict. Fighting has spread into theaters outside the southern Sudan and beyond the Sudan's borders. Not only are Muslims fighting Muslims, but Africans are fighting Africans. A war once described as being fought over scarce resources is now being waged for the total control of abundant oil reserves. The fact that the overall civil war, which is composed of these interlocking struggles, has continued for so long, for contrast, outlasting the international and regional political configurations which at one time seemed to direct and define it, is testimony to the intractability of the underlying causes of the conflict. It's complex, it's a troubled land. It reminds me when I was traveling to Kosovo with the UN Security Council mission, Ambassador Stefan Tavrov of Bulgaria turned to me and said, "Rich, the Balkans have more history than they can digest." And the same is true in Sudan. It predates independence. It predates British colonial power. It predates the Ottoman Empire. There's a lot of history, a lot of struggles, a lot of fights in this land of over 500 tribes and nearly 500 languages. And the politics, I think what Alex just described, by the way, could be said about American politics. or politics in Europe. I think there is a misconception that the drives and activities are different. The only difference is, in our system, there's the pattern, practice, and past performance to reassure peaceful resolution. And in Sudan, like so many other troubled countries, there's not I win, you lose, but you have another predictable time when you can have another chance to win. But as I win, you get to die. So the stakes are different, the way it's played are different, but the motivations and activities are not that dissimilar. And I'm among those who think that at least some of the American and European analysis, which tends to have a moral superiority on the politics, is misplaced. The same drives are there, it just they have different rules. And they don't have a history, they don't have an expectation, they don't have a promise of a reasonable way to accept that you don't have enough primary delegates to be the nominee, but in 4 or 8 years you're going to have another shot. As Alex alluded to, Darfur has become more complex with the bleed between it and Chad. It's my view that the only way to make progress is to change facts on the ground. Somebody pointed out to me, it's not that the parties find the current level of violence acceptable, which they do, but that some of the parties see the current level of violence equaling peace. It's peace. This is as much peace as they've known. So there are people dying. Not too many. So there are people displaced. Manageable. So you have to change the facts for people to reassess their incentives, their aspirations, and how to get it. And I am of the view that the first thing, the most urgent thing, is to try to provide more security, a bigger footprint. If we were to get the 26,000 UNAMID troops on the ground that have been authorized by the UN Security Council, it would not be the answer to Darfur. But it would contribute. It would be an answer. It would provide less space for the vicious violence to continue. And in so doing, instead of a reduction in areas that can receive humanitarian aid, there'd be an increase. And perhaps now, because of the type of bleed back and forth between Chad, there's a growing recognition that some of the parties that have wanted a porous border, whether it's to support Chadian rebels or support GEM rebels, may have an incentive in trying to help close it off. We have the European force on the Chad side now deployed, coordination between the SAF, Sudanese Armed Forces, and UNAMID might help. At least it's a slight change in calibration going on, but I do think it's urgent, and we have to lean forward, and we have to push for a deployment of UNAMID to change the security dynamic somewhat. The government of Sudan has been an impediment. I think the UN has not recognized it's different than other situations in which they've engaged. Most of the places where the UN post-Cold War has intervened when there is a hot conflict going on, there's been little or no central government, East Timor, Sierra Leone, Eastern Congo. Here you've got a strong government. They've got to adjust more in the collaboration and cooperation because Khartoum can create impediments, but some of them are that the UN hasn't adjusted to a different situation. But also, frankly, there have been some who felt that this was a loser mission, that it wasn't going to be able to succeed, and they've dragged their feet. President Bush has come out with a commitment of $100 million, which we've now, through the Sudan Programs Group, allocated for training, equipping, deploying African peacekeepers. By the end of this year, we'll be in a position to double the size of the peacekeepers. But as of today, 6 months into when the AU mission became the hybrid UN-AU mission, I'll get these numbers right, 6 months in, of the peacekeepers on the ground, There are 6,894 former African Union peacekeepers rehatted. And the total addition of UN peacekeepers, 585. So one thing has to be to help change facts on the ground is greater deployment of UN peacekeepers. Second, we have a moral obligation to do a better job in providing humanitarian relief. There's been 27 international humanitarian workers who've been kidnapped this year. There have been a number killed just within the last week. A World Food Program convoy was intercepted and the food stolen. If those two things happen, you might be able to be in a situation to get a political dialogue going. Let make no mistake about it. At this time, Abdul Wahid is happy to be in Paris, where the greatest threat to his life is cholesterol buildup. Even as people die. And Khalil Ibrahim has his own aspirations, and with his run at Omdurman is emboldened, though he probably would be more receptive to a dialogue. There is fragmentation. But we need a political dialogue to lead to a peace process. We support Jan Eliasson, Dr. Salim's efforts. There'll be one mediator hopefully appointed later this week for the UN to try to make progress. But realistically, until you change the incentives, until you change some of the facts, until the primary votes come in from North Carolina, you're not going to force people to reassess whether they have a chance or not to go the way they're going today. I'm going to talk just briefly, if I can, and I'm sorry to try to cover so much, but on the North-South dialogue, and I do think this is an area that President Bush showed an early commitment to, his appointment of my predecessor, Senator Jack Danforth. I think they had an instrumental role to help on the CPA. I think it is a great achievement without all its flaws. I remember what Jacques Klein, who was the SRSG in Bosnia, once said about the Dayton Accords. He said, to end a terrible ethnic war, we ended up with a bad peace deal, but we did end the war. And to some extent, the CPA is that way. It has many weaknesses, among which is a six-year implementation. That means 6 years for both sides to renegotiate by changing the politics, by changing facts on the ground, by changing elements to their advantage as it moves forward. That goes on every day. Just like the two political parties in the United States every day try to jockey position going to the next election. And we're 3 years into it, and some of the fraying is self-evident and dangerous. And among the areas that are especially problematic is the Abyei Protocol, which both sides take the position that this was imposed on them by the U.S., so they don't feel a vested ownership of, fair or unfair. I've seen this in other international situations. We saw that especially in Kosovo. The local actors have to own the solutions. I'm not critical. I wasn't there. I don't know all the elements that went into it. Maybe there was no other way as they were trying to close the gap to end the discussions and move forward with the CPA. But the fact is it's seen as being imposed by them. And unfortunately, within it, one element that the Border Commission was supposed to use, and that was the maps from 1905, then no maps exist. Now, I think the Border Commission quite properly looked at other considerations, local maps, local tribal positioning, and came up with probably the best judgment of where a line would have been. But unfortunately, the Abyei Protocol calls for the maps to be the basis of the decision, and no maps exist, which gives you an escape clause, and of course, that's one the North has taken. Abyei is particularly difficult because it has a lot of disproportionate major political personalities come from Abyei. It's an area where the herding Masuria go back and forth two times a year for their herds. It's an area also with the advantage and the burden of some substantial oil reserves. What we saw in Abyei last month, in my opinion, were local actors, not decisions initially in Khartoum or Juba, where local actors engaged in tit-for-tat escalation of violence. And because this was on a tinderbox, it became inflamed and a scorched earth resulted. But let me just read to you, because I think it's important. As so many things in Sudan, there's not a black and a white, there's not a good guy and a bad guy. I may have my personal views, who has greater moral culpability for opening the gates of hell. But let me just go through some of the elements about what I think is the most objective investigation of chronology of events in Abyei from the 13th to the 24th of May. At around 9 p.m. on the evening of the 13th of May, a Sudan Armed Forces soldier and two civilian traveling by truck were detained by the SPLM police in Dakra, some 7 kilometers north of Abyei town. Stories vary as to the exact sequence of events, but what is not contested is that the SAF soldier that one SAF soldier was shot dead by an SPLM police. One woman, a Mazaria and wife of one of the 31st Brigade SAF, was reported missing. The SAF went to the scene the following morning to investigate, and there were then clashes in which one SPLA soldier was killed and one wounded, and 3 SAF were killed. Later this same morning, there were some gunshots in town, followed by heavy gunfire, et cetera, et cetera. The point being that both sides were engaged in violent acts. That doesn't excuse that a few days into it, a decision which probably was made in Khartoum to keep the Sudan Armed Forces in their garrison and therefore give a green light for Mazaria to come and loot and burn was made. And that was unconscionable. And I've been to Abyei town since then, and it looks like the apocalypse. 95% plus of the homes are burned to the ground. You have charred bed frames, burnout metal water barrels. You've got melted plastic bottles everywhere, scraps of clothing. And you have 50,000 people whose lives were shattered who now live in swampland with plastic over their heads. But the point I want to make is that that human tragedy still has not been enough to motivate the parties as it should to respond constructively. And that this violence that began locally has resulted in such human suffering. But old grudges, old posturing, old positions are hard to give up. Both sides, when I was in Sudan last, asked me to engage as a facilitator. Having been burned a few times, I made both of them do it publicly. Spent a lot of time from early in the morning to 1:30 at night, day after day, trying to talk through the issues that had to be dealt with Abyei, because we felt the most important thing was to de-escalate this tinderbox, because we had both forces close up. And let me just note that when the violence was going on, there was one person who should be acknowledged for showing unusual political leadership, for doing something that hurt himself politically, and that is President Salva Kiir of the government of Southern Sudan. He kept the SPLA troops north of the river, at my request, and I'm sure others as well, for which he got tremendous political criticism, and it was in the middle of a very rambunctious SPLM convention, so it was accentuated. But I want to acknowledge that, and I think it was important, and I think it showed the kind of leadership that's going to be required if we are going to get implementation of the CPA, and if the CPA collapses, as I said earlier, progress in Darfur will be impossible. It wasn't hard to think of the elements that had to be done in Abyei and to outline particulars, which I did with both sides separately during a series of many discussions. And generally, they agreed on the elements until they got together and they were more interested in saying it was your responsibility, it was your responsibility, it's your fault, etc. To which is very discouraging. 50,000 more people's lives were shattered, but people were trying to score political points behind the door. So when I said neither side, when I walked out finally and said neither side is showing the pragmatic desire to try to bridge the gaps, I meant it, and I still do, which isn't the same as saying there's moral equivalency. But both sides had to do more than they were doing. I'm pleased that a few days later, I spent a lot of time on the phone with parties from both sides the next few days, and a few days later they actually cut a deal along what we outlined, and I just want to go through it quickly. First and most importantly, it was in both sides' interest to de-escalate. They have not made a decision. Neither side has made a decision they want to go back to war. Indeed, I'd say both sides have made a decision they don't want to go back to war. There are fault lines in this imperfect agreement, the CPA, between now and just 2011, when you're going to see the referendum. There are fault lines, there's fragility, there are going to be problems. Abiy is the most exposed tinderbox. But neither side at this point has decided they want to go back to war, so they both had an interest in de-escalating, even if the humanitarian compassion probably was different on one side than the other. So on security, we talked about putting in an integrated police unit, taking one from Khartoum and bringing it down that both sides felt comfortable with. Bringing in a joint integrated unit, this was something the CPA called for. Unfortunately, as I said to both sides separately, can you tell me one unit that's actually joint, one that's actually integrated, one that's united? None of them could. I'm disappointed. I was trying to push for more training and support to try to get a really joint integrated unit, but at least something both sides agreed to is on its way down there. UNMISS failed in its responsibility. That's the UN peacekeepers between the north and south. There are 300 in the garrison in Abiy town. They have a Chapter 7 resolution. It specifically says among their responsibilities is to intervene to protect innocent civilians, but in classic UN fashion with an escape clause based on their capacity to do it. There were homes burnt to the ground 25 feet away from the garrison. No one left the garrison. This was a topic of discussion with the local commander, with the SRSG, in Sudan yesterday with Jean-Marie Gaynaud, the senior UN official, undersecretary for peacekeeping, at a luncheon the Friends of UNAMID had in New York with ambassadors, and in a later ARIA-style meeting with various NGOs. We have to change the mentality. This is not unique. Same thing happened with the Moroccan peacekeeper mission in Kisangani in 2002, where 85 heads floated down the Congo River, and they didn't leave their garrison. But it's unacceptable. We're paying $1 billion a year for UNMISS. This was their first great test, and they failed. So part of that we now are looking at is freedom of movement for the troops and being more robust in the direction to make sure the local commander can't stay in the garrison but must go out. I've seen many of these situations tragically around the world. It doesn't take that much to chill looters. These are not brave people. They're cowards that go in after the civilians have left to try to steal all they can and burn. Indeed, the looting finally stopped. Late in the afternoon before I went to Abiy, I called Nafi al-Nafi to let him know I was going to Abiy town as a courtesy. He said, you shouldn't do that. It's not safe. I said, I'm going to go. He said, you shouldn't do that. I'm not safe. I said, fine. And if you're not willing to, unless you tell me you think you're going to shoot me down, I'm going to be going to Abiy town. 2 hours later, the instructions went for the SAF to get out of their garrison and begin to patrol the town again, and the looting stopped. It doesn't take that much. But anyway, the security with the police, the JIU, and UNMISS then allows both the SAF and the SPLA to pull back, which both sides have agreed to do, to designated areas so they won't be so close to each other. The likelihood of a mistake, a miscalculation, a local actor igniting conflict would be bad. Second, a temporary administration where the chief administrator will be from the SPLM, but appointed by President Beshear. The deputy chief administrator will be from the NCP, appointed by President Beshear, and the rest of the personnel being professional technocrats. Nothing's easy. A couple personalities would be clearly unacceptable. Both sides wanted to go with a personality that they knew the other side would go away with. After a few days of what we call full and frank exchanges, I think we backed off that so we actually get administrators' names so we can get a temporary administration up, but last vote in Florida hasn't been counted yet, but I think it's going to happen. Then there was the big issue, the border question. As I said, the FBA Border Commission report was not accepted by Khartoum. There was discussion of arbitration to try to get a final solution. There had been a series of maps the North had proposed to the South that had got, each one was getting slightly closer to the ABC border. For a long time, there was I called it the barbell map. There was part in the West and part in the East that were kind of in limbo that stayed in the North, but both sides recognized something had to be done eventually with. They've worked out the West. The East is hardest because that's where the oil is. I struggled to try to get the debate beyond the border. The border politically means a lot more to the South than the North. It means a lot because of what I said with respect to the strong political personalities from ABA. It means more symbolically. And the fact is it has been porous, allowing the Masurria twice a year to come down to do their grazing. To the North, it was my view, and I expressed to both sides, it was about revenue, understandably. But let's stop talking about the border. Let's talk about revenue, because once you talk about money, there's at least ways to try to deal with it. And at least through this crisis, the debate has shifted, and there is discussions of going about oil revenue. So it's not just a kilometer of land this way or that. So we have a temporary border which still has not dealt with those difficult issues in the East. We have a window for political dialogue to see if there can be a solution. It's working on Sudanese time, which that means that there has been no subsequent discussions of any merit since the deal was signed. We're fighting over chief administrator, deputy chief administrator. We're avoiding the tough issue, the more important, the core issue. I personally suspect that the window for the political dialogue might be stretched a little bit. But they also have agreed to arbitration. I push strongly to avoid the mistakes of the ABC, well-intended, but the ABA protocol has not worked, that we should at this point deal with the difficult issues, because every arbitration by definition is sui generis. It's not like going to a court of law. So the terms of reference, the criterion on which a decision will be made, who will be the deciders, either the personality or the criteria? What evidence is acceptable, written and oral? What's the timeline? What's the appeal process? What's the enforcement mechanism? These are all components. It's not enough to say we're going to go to arbitration. I was successful in both sides at least saying to me privately they agreed, and profoundly unsuccessful at getting them to address it when the crisis was in front of them and I thought might focus their attention. I think that is what is going to have to be addressed between now and when it's triggered to arbitration. And I've had some requests to, as I said, after I walked out, within hours, I was getting calls from both sides. For the next few days, I spent a lot of time with President Salva Kiir on the phone and others. what little value my advice might have, and contributed. Since then, I've continued to talk. I've had requests to go back. My view is they have to work on this on their own for a while. They have to own this solution. Arbitration will only work if both sides are fully vested in the process and accept that they may not get what they want, or they certainly won't get all that they want. That is a difficult challenge in ABA now, and I think continues to be the greatest challenge to the CPA. The next great challenge to the CPA will be the election in 2009. We had an imperfect census where the requirement to include ethnicity and religion were left off. Speculation, of course, being it was left off because the government in Khartoum didn't want the answer of what the majority was, Arab or non-Arab, or what the majority religion was, Islam or non-Islam. But the census has gone forward. There will so the next two challenges I would suggest on the CPA is trying to get beyond, to get the de-escalation of ABA done, hopefully try to get a pathway to a final solution, either through a political dialogue or arbitration. I think it'll be wise, even if we trigger the time frame and go to arbitration, for the two parties simultaneously to be trying to find a political solution that could preempt the arbitration. It is in their interest, but just like American politicians, politicians don't always do what's in their interest. And the U.S. is going to try to be supportive to the degree it can. Thanks very much.
Our next speaker is Vanessa. Vanessa?
Thank you very much all for coming. It's a hard act to follow, and I'm not going to imagine that you all come here just to hear me speak, but in my own head I'm going to think about that a little bit. But I would like to thank for the kind words of Ambassador Williamson, specifically with respect to highlighting ABA in his words. That is what I've been called here specifically to do. Yes, Public International Law and Policy Group is a global pro bono law firm, and we do provide direct legal assistance to the government of Southern Sudan on CPA implementation issues. One of those implementation issues, obviously, is ABA. And I'm glad that we have a panel here that is focusing directly on ABA, as well as other issues, but most directly on ABA, because this is a very serious issue. And as many of you know, commentators, activists, government officials of all sides and from various countries have been warning for a while that the potential for a renewed crisis in ABA, and therefore a reopening of the CPA and a reopening of a civil war, was very possible. And what we saw most recently in mid-May, and the violence in mid-May that we are now dealing with, was in fact, unfortunately, the reality that so many people had already predicted, that a security situation was brewing there, and that a crisis and a potential return to civil war was very possible. In mid-April, I read an article in New York Times, and it was actually speaking about normalization of relations between the U.S. and the Sudan. And I'd like to read you a line. It referred to noncompliance of peace agreements particularly by the National Congress Party, is what it was mentioning. And I quote, "The Sudanese government has signed several peace agreements relating to Darfur or another internal conflict in the non-Arab southern part of Sudan." Didn't even mention the comprehensive peace agreement, and it didn't even mention ABA, which we all know is a flashpoint then and certainly right now. And so I think the idea that we're focusing more greatly on ABA right now is very important. Yes, it is the bridge between the North and South. Some believe that, yes, the failure to grant the rights of self-determination to the ABA residences back in the 80s exactly what put the country back on trail to another war. And I think that while it is this bridge, there's much in ABA that could unite Sudan, just as much as there's much that could divide Sudan. And I think it's hard to talk about the comprehensive peace agreement without talking about ABA, and it's hard to talk about ABA without talking about all of the critical aspects of the comprehensive peace agreement, whether that's IDPs, whether that's security, whether that's economic development, whether that's equitable wealth and power sharing. So ABA is very critical. And Darfur absolutely is very critical. And so is Beja is very critical. But chances are, if ABA falls apart, the CPA falls apart. And if the CPA falls apart, then certainly a solution to Darfur is certainly not going to be in our near future. So how do what do we need to do? We need to focus on ABA here. And where are we going right now? Well, as Emma Williamson just pointed out, we have a roadmap now. What do we think about this roadmap? When I'm asked about what I think about the roadmap, I think, well, half glass full is that there's a serious humanitarian crisis happening in Abyei and a potential to go back to war over Abyei. So I'm certainly pleased that the parties sat down and negotiated an Abyei roadmap. This will hopefully deal with the humanitarian disasters, hopefully get police, security forces there, and possibly even resolve the border issue. On the other hand, I also think of it as a bit glass half empty. Why? Because we have an ABA roadmap, and we needed an ABA roadmap. But we already had a roadmap, and that was the CPA, and the CPA was binding. And we had an ABA protocol, and that was binding. And we had an ABC report, and that was binding based on the terms of reference and the ABA protocol. So now we have an ABA roadmap because those binding provisions weren't implemented. So that's my glass half empty there. The fact that we have the ABA roadmap, the fact that we need an ABA roadmap, says that we're not paying enough attention to ABA, including the international community. What will make this a binding agreement more complied with than any of the binding agreements before? That's something we have to talk about. Glass half empty, is it just another mechanism for containment? Another mechanism for containment, which was the initial Darfur peace agreement, which was the Beja peace agreement, some people even say the CPA agreement, and now we have at least 6 to 9 months, and it's likely going to take longer, we all know that, to delay another decision of a critical border issue on Abyei. Is that a half glass empty scenario? I believe so. I believe it also represented the international community essentially abandoning Abyei, and in this case, I would have to say particularly the SPLM. I don't think this was an agreement that the SPLM walked into in a favorable manner, again, because we had three other binding agreements before that, but it was necessary. It was necessary. Who is this agreement between? I think it's also interesting to note that this agreement is not between the CPA parties. This agreement, right? The CPA parties are who? The government of Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, and Army. This is an agreement between the National Congress Party and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. We can derive a number of items from that, but it does concern me just a bit. Okay. I think Amba Williamson already addressed what is basically in the agreement. It covers issues of security. It covers issues of establishing the interim administration, both of which are relatively supposed to happen within 2 weeks. And in fact, I believe I just read a notice about a day or two ago, though, that a presidential decree has been issued regarding the establishment of the administration, hopefully better than prior draft presidential decrees regarding the administration. But luckily, the Abyei roadmap was very faithful to Abyei protocol and seems to be establishing an administration that is exactly contemplated by the protocol, well-funded by independent sources, as well as the Reconstruction Fund, as well as with the proper appointments and the proper authorities. It also has provisions regarding oil that are wrapped in there. There's two provisions. They're a little bit vague, but they seem to be getting at the idea that somewhere in the interim, while the arbitration is moving, that some form of arrears, that some form of ongoing revenues from those areas will at a minimum be put into a fund to begin some kind of reconstruction, particularly on the north-south border, right? The protocol provides for an Abyei reconstruction fund just for Abyei. This doesn't refer to that. It refers to a larger fund for the north-south border. So it's an interesting issue, and we'll have to see how that plays out. Obviously, there's an issue of getting the IDPs back once the security arrangements are put forth, and also the arbitration. And what is the arbitration tasked with doing? Quote, unquote, to settle their dispute over the findings of the ABC. To settle their disputes over the findings of the ABC. So what exactly does that mean going forward? I'd like to talk just a little bit more directly about the issue of the arbitration, because as we know, this border definition is quite important, not just because obviously it establishes the jurisdiction of the Abyei administration, but obviously because of the oil, and I think Amber Williamson pointed that out very, very directly. So what's next? What do the parties have to do? Well, first they have to decide, right? The duration of the arbitration is 6 to 9 months. First, they have to decide how are they going to carry out that arbitration. The agreement says that they're going to sit down and determine some terms of reference. Well, first of all, how are they going to carry out the arbitration? It could be everything from associating to a well-known arbitral institution like the Permanent Court of Authority who will help administer it. And this could be a positive thing if you attach it to an arbitral institution that already exists and has experience. We might be able to actually see the realization of this very short 6 to 9 month duration that's been put on this arbitration, because that's somewhat unreasonable, but let's see if we can do. They can also just develop their own ad hoc system, which could provide some more autonomy and could be beneficial as well. Or they can also establish a whole international specialized quasi-permanent tribunal, probably overshooting. We probably don't need just that. But then, most importantly, they have to determine terms of reference and rules of procedure. I think when it comes to the terms of reference, perhaps the most critical issue, and that's been touched upon by our panelists already, is this issue of what will be the mandate of this arbitral body? What will be the mandate? Are they going to relitigate the ABC report? Are we going to reopen it all up? Are we going to have three new people, hopefully independent, hopefully qualified, review all of the documentation, have another hearing, do site visits, look for maps, examine maps, go to archives, visit with the Miseria? Are we going to have them do that? Because that is what the ABC does. The mandate, let's be clear, the mandate of the ABC was not go find a map. Nowhere in the ABA protocol does it say, go find a map from 1905. In fact, in the terms of reference and the rules of procedures for the ABC, it goes much farther than finding a map. It goes into interviewing people. It goes into site visits. It goes into archives. If it was just about a map, you know what they could have done? They could have said, go find a map. And if you don't find the map, come back to the parties and we'll tell you what to do. If they wanted an administrative boundary, they could have said, put in an administrative boundary. But they didn't. On four separate occasions, the parties to the CPA agreed to one singular mandate. Without clarification, it said to define and demarcate the areas of the 9 Nas Dinka chiefdoms as transferred to Southern Kotra in 1905. It did not say the administrative border. It did not say go find a 1905 map. And on four separate occasions, the parties sat down, first with the Abbey Protocol, then in the annex, then in the terms of reference, then when they sat down to define the rules of procedures, and this same mandate was said over and over again, and no one raised their hand and said, well, this is how we interpret it. It's about going to find a map. It's about an administrative border. And in fact, they defined a very ample set of terms and rules of procedures for the ABC, which involved a whole lot of tasks, many tasks which were, in fact, not many, I should say, all of the tasks which were very much completed. But when we come to the arbitration, we really do have to look at this issue of what will be the mandate of this tribunal. Again, relitigating, or is it about determining if the ABC did or didn't exceed their mandate, and then moving forward after that? In terms of the rules of procedure, a lot of issues have to be discussed, everything from the location, the language of the tribunal, the rules of evidence, as Emma Williams spoke about. What do I think is most important here? Perhaps when we talk about the rules of procedure and the terms of references, how can we make sure that this tribunal's decision, unlike other binding documents we've seen in Sudan, is in fact binding and enforced? And I think one of the ways, and moves forward in a good faith and an expedition and efficient manner, I think one of the ways that we can do that is making sure that the parties, with international community support and pressure if needed, develop strong terms of reference and rules of procedures. Strong terms of reference that ensure that delay tactics can't be utilized. That means if you give a decision to the parties, if those parties can't come up with an answer, default it to somebody else who can do it. Let's keep this moving. It means that including provisions that ensures that the international community also has buy-in into this. What does that mean? Well, that can mean that they endorse the agreement in the same way that they endorse the CPA. It can mean that they're helping to fund the arbitral process. It could also mean that there's an agreement by the parties that's endorsed by the community that whatever arbitral award arises will in fact be forwarded and ratified by the Security Council under preferably its Chapter 6 and 7 powers. These are things that can help to ensure that the award is actually binding, is actually implemented. Of course, one could also try to incorporate within the terms of reference and rules of procedures incentives to comply and incentives to not delay. For instance, if the parties know that there will be a financial cost to their delay, perhaps because they're putting arrears or current revenues into a fund, you know, current revenues generated from that disputed area in a fund that can't be accessed until the arbitration is complete. That would be an incentive not to issue delays. Now, in terms of the arbitration, hopefully we will get to a final conclusion about the Avier boundary. Hopefully we will. But there will still be other issues. Aside from that, let's assume that there's implementation too, right? Let's assume even that there's implementation. There are still going to be other issues that have to be addressed. And given my time, I won't go through. I will just kind of list a couple and give a few points. But I think, first of all, the improved security of the area, I think the roadmap already lays up some groundwork on that. But I think that we can also do some more there. And lifting the unmissed restrictions was a good way to do this. And certainly, I agree with Envoy Williamson that the training of the JIUs is extremely important. And for some reason, UNMISS is not suitably financed or can do that, then that needs to be bumped to somebody else who can appropriately do that. In terms of the ABDA administration itself that's set up, let's just make sure that it's set up properly, consistent with the ABDA protocol, with all of its financial backing that was contemplated by the protocol, which includes resources from the government as well as independent resources. And to ensure that everything in the ABIA protocol can be implemented, even if there's just an interim border. In fact, the ABIA protocol provided that an administration could be set up even if the ABC never delivered the report. So there's absolutely no reason why this can't be a functioning administration. We can also probably support some local governance activities. The Nine Nakdinka chiefs are forming an ABIA Common Trust. They're working very strong on trying to respond to their constituencies and work with the humanitarian agencies that are down there. Some had proposed at one point an international transitional administration. I don't think that that's probably necessary right now, not to mention not practical. However, I do feel strongly that based on the fact that we now have this roadmap, there is very good reasons, especially once security is in place, to increase foreign presence there, not just of NGOs. If we can have, for instance, foreign service personnel Fashion.4, there's no reason why we can't have somebody as well in Abyei. And I think other countries can do the same. And by doing that, if they have point representatives there, I think as Envoy Williamson realized with what his presence did when he was there in terms of helping with essentially a ceasefire and a backing off, then certainly if there are representatives from governments in other countries, diplomatic representatives, I think it'll show the international community support and will help to bolster, and they can work directly with the government there. I think also we need to think about independent agreements concerning natural resources. As was mentioned, much of ABIA is about natural resources, and even if we have a binding agreement, we're still going to have to work some things out, not just now, but what happens after 2011 when when the outcome possibly is separation, or even if it isn't. We can work out joint development zones, unitization agreements. In other words, where two parties share a resources without ceding who owns it and who doesn't. We need to reaffirm grazing rights and other rights of those migrating through Abyei as well post-2011. They're concerned about their transboundary rights when suddenly there's a sovereign border there. We need to talk about those kinds of things. So it's not just about oil. It's going to be dealing with their issues as well. We have to prepare for the 2009 elections. You all know what has to happen there, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. Also, if we're going to talk about normalization, because I know that's all in the press, what I'd like to think about, too, is normalization between the Miseria and the Nakdinka. I think we need to re-engage the Miseria and the Nakdinka. They're having their own local reconciliation efforts, and I think that that's very important. The international community provides a lot of lip service to the importance of invigorating this dialogue, that these groups have a history of managing their relationships, and certainly though not made public, they have had a number of meetings since the CPA, and they tend to have more in common than the public would know or that the press will allow us to. So I think that it is important to invigorate that, while at the same time and educating them about what the CPA says and various related agreements. And last, I would say ensuring IDPs placements, as well as increasing the role of the international community. I mentioned some things that they could do with respect to the roadmap in terms of the international community, but it could mean reestablishing the IGAD secretariat. I think certainly a stronger, more autonomous mandate for the AC and a more active role of the Assessment Evaluation Commission is definitely needed. And last, I would argue that it might be interesting to have the parties actually form some kind of a joint council to actually look at post-2011 outcomes. This might seem odd, given that they're tasked mostly with trying to make unity attractive, and many of us believe, and there's great fear, that the 2011 outcome is actually one of separation. But we know that the fear and concerns about those unknowns in 2011 are informing their current policies. So it'd be a tragic mistake to ignore them. I think have the party sit down and talk about 2011 outcomes would be and options and solutions would be quite helpful, even to create space and relieve tensions that are happening right now. Thank you very much.
I want to thank CSIS and USIP for putting this together at a critical moment, I might add. I want to first commend the job that Rich Williamson is doing. I certainly have very great confidence in him personally. We've known each other for many years, but he's an excellent diplomat, and he understands, whether he's been involved in this for 18 years or not, is not the question. He understands what the interests are of the different parties to the conflict or the potential conflict, and he understands what needs to get done. And I think the approach that he is taking is exactly the right approach, a negotiated way out of this. Let me make a couple of comments here, which I have to say, my view of what was happening in Sudan shifted as I talked with all of the sides, not only in Darfur, but in the different factions in the south, the different factions in the NCP, because we all act as though there is a group of Darfuris that are all united with one position. That's complete nonsense. I think most of us know that. The south is not united. There are factions in the south. A faction that wants a negotiated way out of this and wants independence, and another faction that realizes that if the South separates, they will be isolated because they will be left in the North. The Blue Nile province is not going to go with the South after the 2011 elections. The Nuba Mountains is staying in the North no matter what happens in the elections in 2011. And the Ngok Dinka, who are from Abyei, also know that depending on how that referendum goes and who votes in it, it will affect where they are. So the people who are in the South and will separate in 2011 have a different view of what needs to happen in Abyei and in all of these issues, because lots of people in the South said, we're fed up with the Arabs, we simply want the South to separate. My own view is, if the entire leadership of the SPLM, the entire leadership, the entire church community, which are very powerful in the South, all said, vote for unity, the people won't vote for unity. They are fed up with the Arabs. They're fed up with Islam. I'm just telling you what their views are. They have a long history that goes back more than 25 years, for centuries. The slave trade in the 19th century was absolutely appalling, depopulated the Nuer homeland. It was so massive. The people are fed up with it, and they are going to vote to separate, in my view. That's their opinion. I'm just giving you my view. For us to ignore the reality of what's going on in Sudan, in this sort of sterile environment in the so-called international community. The notion that there is an international community in Sudan is nonsense. There is no international community. There are factions within the international community that take very different views of what need to happen. The Africans are appalled by what is happening in Darfur. They're with the southerners. However, they're afraid of destabilization affecting them in a profound way, and they'll tell you that privately, very much afraid of that. In fact, most of the neighboring countries are preparing for the dissolution of Sudan, not between the North and the South, but the dissolution of the North. They're really afraid of that and the consequences to the neighborhood. The Asians take a different view of this. The Arab world takes a different view of this. And I think the notion that there's this sort of international community that has a unified position, if we only leveraged ourselves, we can make all of these things happen by pressure from the outside. If the parties to the political system of Sudan that Alex described earlier don't see it in their interest, they may sign every agreement, including the southerners, will sign agreements and never implement them if it's not in their interest. And so we need to look at what we can do to facilitate and mediate a grand political agreement that the parties in Sudan agreed to. I think Rich's strategy of saying to them, you need to work this out. I had a Yale Law School graduate, who is the editor of a large newspaper, very critical of the United States publicly, tell me at a private dinner I had with some friends of mine who I've known for many years in Khartoum when I first started. And he said, the only country that can fix the problems of Sudan is the United States. I said, please, doctor, this is complete nonsense. The notion the United States is going to fix all the problems of Sudan, that's utterly ridiculous. We can't fix our own problems domestically in the United States. We're going to go in Sudan and fix all of their problems by imposing it from the outside through 25 Security Council resolutions? Come on, this is ridiculous. And it's living in a delusional world if we think that. Can we influence the process? Yes. But if we start trying to impose something in the outside, that it's a zero-sum game, that one side loses everything and the other side gains everything, it's not going to work. It will not last. It will not last. Now, very quickly, one factor that people are forgetting is to look at the interests of the different parties. The Mezaria Arabs are split. 5,000 Mezaria Arabs joined the SPLA. They're in the SPLA right now. Dr. Nafi was enraged when that happened, and I won't even say what he told me privately when I told him. He knew it had happened. When I told him that, his reaction was quite interesting from my perspective. Half of the Mezaria Arabs hate the central government. In fact, most of them hate him. All right. So there's an issue over their grazing rights that has to be dealt with, and the fear they have is that the self separates, that they will not be able to move their cows, who will die if they can't move during the dry season into the south. Those negotiations, which are going on now, they've been going on for some time. The Southerners are facilitating this. The Southerners understand much better what the interests are among the Mezaria than any of us do. Okay. The second thing is we need to understand the only oil left in the north, if the south separates, is in Abyei. Virtually all the oil left for the north is there. It's a huge amount of oil. It's floating in oil. But according to the Norwegian oil envoy, they have an oil envoy who's an expert. He's from their gas and oil industry in Norway. He's a very bright guy. He did an extensive briefing to all of us in the diplomatic community and to the Sudanese Petroleum Ministry until he annoyed them by saying something he didn't like and they threw him out. But he's a very bright guy, and he said those oil fields are going to be all depleted by 2019. There'll be almost nothing left. 95% of the oil will be gone. The notion we're going to have a bloodbath, which we could very well have, not just a city burned down, but tens of thousands of people killed, and another war started, over oil fields that are going to be depleted by 2019, is very sad. It's very disturbing. And so, and the Northern and the Southern understand this. So I think if a deal can be made on oil for land, the ABC boundary in exchange for which some deal is made over the oil revenue, which is apparently the discussions that are taking place right now, and the Mezaria Arabs' nomadic rights to grazing land can be dealt with, then the basic interests over this explosive area can be dealt with. But I want to focus, emphasize the point that this must be the Southerners and the Northerners that do this. We can facilitate, we can mediate, which is exactly what Rich is doing. Let me make a second set of comments in terms of the effect all of us have on what's going on in Sudan. We live in a dream world in terms of the amount of leverage we have. Okay? We live in a dream world. The neighboring countries have far more influence over what is going on in Darfur. And I can mention the countries. Libya and Chad and Eritrea have more influence over what is happening in Darfur than the entire rest of the so-called international community combined. Far more influence. They have people on the ground, they have money, they have weapons. I'm not going to go into the details of what that means because it gets into intelligence, but we have very little leverage compared to what they have. And their interests are not aligned with each other. They're in rival with each other. The neighbors don't agree on what the solution is on Darfur between the north and the south. All of the neighbors are worried about what's happening, but their fears are different from each other. So there is no unified view of the neighboring country. And it's not a matter of us not pressuring them or anything else. They're looking at their national self-interests. Do we blame them? I mean, what do we do when we look at an issue that affects our country's survival? We look at our national interests. You know, we are dealing with this as an ethical issue, a moral issue, a human rights issue. That's not what people in the neighborhood are thinking about, including people in Sudan. They're thinking about their survival. Because after we all lose attention and lose interest in this, they'll still be stuck there. They're not moving. Sudan is not going to be moved to some other area of the world. It's the way it is. We need to be a little bit more humble in our capacity to influence the course of events. I think we can facilitate things. There are things we're doing now with the South to strengthen the South institutionally, which will reduce the risk of the North ever attacking the South again. We are doing that. That is actually more important than any of these negotiations, because it's affecting the Northern calculation of the vulnerability of the South. In fact, I believe now the North is far more vulnerable than the South is, despite whatever people think of from the outside. If you look at what is going on inside the country from a military perspective, this is the weakest government militarily that Sudan has had since 1956. And I've had people in the government in the North privately tell me they're very, very nervous. Now, let me conclude with this. You cannot separate in Abyei or any of these calculations what's happening, what just happened in Omdurman. That had a profound effect on the paranoia level, the obstructionism, and the fears of the Nile River app, not just of the NCP. Last November, when they almost went to war, you know, they massed huge numbers of troops last November. That was the first Abyei crisis. This is not the first Abyei crisis last month. The first Abyei crisis was last November, and they were about to go to war in a way that would look like the Eritrean-Ethiopian war, with huge casualties in a military perspective. Would have been enormous. That was diffused. I mean, we play the role in facilitating that, but Salva Kiir and President Bashir basically negotiated that, to pull everybody back and do the right thing. We facilitated, but we didn't pressure them to do it. They saw it in their interest to do it. And our role was to facilitate, to mediate, to encourage. The reality is, in my view, that the risk of a dissolution of the country and massive human rights abuses in Greater Khartoum are very substantial. And if we do not consider what the consequences are to the rest of the country, we could find ourselves with something like Somalia, something like what happened to the Congo, which could be catastrophic from a humanitarian perspective. We are always assuming that the interventions we make are going to improve things from a human rights perspective, when in fact they could have unintended consequences that well-meaning people, including me, I mean, I thought of myself as well-meaning through all of this, and I began to realize some of the things I may have been doing may have actually moved us closer to that reality instead of further away. And I had to constantly recalculate what I was doing to see whether or not the interventions in the international community was actually forcing greater potential for dissolution of the country or not. They need a political deal. And one of the problems now is the divisions. There's a peace faction in the northern government. They want a negotiated deal. And there's a hardliner faction that wants no deal. And the same problem exists in the South. Until there's more unity of position in the South and in the North in the NCP, it's going to be hard to make a deal. I think my opinion of watching this is President Bashir, who has been siding with the hardliners, is beginning to shift his position toward the moderates who want an accommodated settlement to this. I mean not just to Abyei, but to a whole series of other issues. And what we do or do not do is going to influence that. And I might add, I want to say this, now I'm separated from the administration. I spent a day with Mr. Ocampo. I will not tell you where, but with other mediators from other conflicts. This is after I left office, not while I was in office. If the ICC goes ahead with the threats in the newspaper that they're going to indict further senior figures in the Sudanese government, we will drive the country closer to dissolution. And I have to say, the view of the ICC tribunal and the view is they don't care. They said, we're not interested. We have no interest in the diplomacy of this. It's none of our business. All we care about is no impunity, justice. My view is, it was then and it is now, the first priority is a peaceful settlement to this so we don't have another catastrophe. And the notion that we're going to kill 300,000 or 400,000 people in order to get someone indicted, who will never get indicted anyway, they're not going to go on trial, is crazy. It doesn't make any sense for the Sudanese people. It may make all of us feel better, and it may establish a view that this won't happen again because we're punishing people. That is not what the reality is. The reality is the ICC endorsements and indictments in northern and the LRA and northern Uganda are postponing a peace settlement. And we now know what's going on in Zimbabwe. The senior leadership and senior intellectuals in Zimbabwe have publicly said this. The major factor in why Mugabe will not agree to some compromise is the Charles Taylor factor. They are afraid that the senior leadership, military, the secret police, and Mugabe are all going to go up on trial like Charles Taylor. That's the fear. Now, what's most important for the Zimbabwean people? Justice? You know, I would like them all on trial in Zimbabwe. But the fact of the matter is, what's most important for, from a human rights perspective and for the people of Zimbabwe is the settlement of this. That's true in northern Uganda, and in my view, it's true in Sudan as well. So I think we should be a little bit more thoughtful about the consequences of international interventions in various ways to what is actually going on in the country that could lead to far greater bloodshed later on that all of us will deeply regret. Thank you.
Let me once again urge people to fill in any seats that people get up and vacate. I'm told that our video outside, our video and audio, wasn't working earlier. I'm told it is working now, so anybody whose knees are getting weak can sit outside and still hear and see the proceedings. Steve, we're going to have to use the two microphones,
okay,
one on either side, for people who want to ask questions. Please line up as best you can. I know it's crowded, but we need to use the microphones so that the recording is complete. Steve?
Thank you very much. You've all been very patient. I think we've heard a couple of strong things here this morning. One is that the U.S. role remains terribly important here, but we've heard a lot of caution about it being episodic, about not overburdening it, about not relieving the incentives upon the parties themselves. I think another powerful impression is that the international oversight mechanisms are quite weak here. The sharing of initiative is just not clear. I mean, what kind of structure is going to make sense looking forward? The strengthening of the UN remains terribly important. There is the outline of a land and oil deal, I think, inherent in everything that we've heard about on this Abyei, is that there is the outline of a deal there. The question is, will it be possible to pull it forward? The parties themselves drove to the brink, but they also pulled back, which is interesting. You know, that the argument here that there were incentives that pulled people back, not the least of which was not wanting to destroy the CPA and not wanting to destroy the oil sector. I'm glad that Andrew brought up the ICC, which remains, I think, a very potent wild card in this overall equation. I would suggest that we move to take three or four quick comments. One question, 1 minute, please, each of you, and then we will come back to to Rich and our other presenters. Sir?
So one question?
Yeah, one question, 1 minute, and then we'll move forward. So please be very brief and narrow your comment or question to one single item, please. Sir?
Okay. My name is Talha Jibril. I'm a journalist from the Sharq al-Awsat newspaper. My question to Ambassador Williamson. So you described the situation in Sudan, what should happen in Darfur, what should happen in Abyei, and what should happen in the south, between the south and the north. But my question, what you as the administration, what exactly you, what is your initiative to achieve this? It's not a matter of definition and describing what's going on, but my question, whether you have something concrete for the Sudanese so that they can, we have like a roadmap or something like that.
Great, thank you. Let's take two or three more, Anna.
Anna Majer Barducci from Sharq al-Awsat, the newspaper.
Speak up a bit, please.
Yeah, the question is, like, if you, to Rich Williamson, whether he thinks that in this administration there's going to be, like, normalization between Khartoum and Washington, and then if you can give also a comment about what's going on in Chad and the influence that are going to be in Sudan.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm Scott Stedman with Oxfam. Ambassador Williamson, you mentioned how UNMISS wasn't very proactive in the situation in Abyei, and we're seeing the same thing in Darfur with UNAMID, where, yes, they only have a certain amount of troops, but they are not doing much to respond to violence and not really protecting civilians very much. What can the U.S. do, so this is for Ambassador Williamson or whoever else, to make them more proactive, not just to build the numbers, but make them more proactive in fulfilling their mandate besides just protecting themselves?
Great. Thank you very much. Sir?
Thank you. My name is Eli Junaid. I'm from Embassy of Sudan. My first question is for...
No, your only question.
Yeah? Yeah. I mean, I have a question which is, has two parties. I mean...
One question.
Yeah, yeah.
One question, 1 minute.
That's good.
In fact, it was directed to both the, all the panelists. So, for Special Envoy, he has suspended his talks in Khartoum with the two parties, and then they have agreed to this roadmap. What is next? The same question is for Professor Alex Diwan and Mr. Natius. For Alex Diwan, what is needed from the government? I think the government, especially in Darfur, the government position concerning the peace talks is very clear. The other side is very ambiguous. What is needed from the government? For Professor Matthews,
you're stepping over the boundary.
No, just three parts of the question. The same, it's one question, but three parts.
Oh, we're done. Let's hold off. Let's go back to we've got a number of questions on the table. Rich.
Well, the first observation is Sudan's not the only place where there's chaos. First, to what the U.S. is going to do, roadmap for Sudan. First, let me note that the U.S. is contributing over $300 million a year to UNAMID, over $250 million a year to UNMISS, added $100 million bilaterally to train African peacekeepers, is involved as the largest single contributor to humanitarian assistance through WFP and other things. So the U.S. is engaged in a range of dimensions, both and not doing enough on electricity, I guess, doing a variety of things to try to help. But let me be more specific. As I've said, my experience in my first ambassadorship was 25 years ago, is that the U.S. often has a hubris that it can impose solutions. It can't. It cannot impose a solution in Sudan.
Or Iraq.
As one senior Sudanese government official noted to me, the Sudan... certain Western countries might have the capacity to change the regime, but that won't solve the problem. So one of the things I try to do is be realistic with both sides on what not only the United States but others can and should do. With all due respect, the Abyei Protocol is a failure. Telling either party that they should appeal to it and that that's going to have a way forward and therefore they're more intransigent is just prolonging the problem, not helping find a solution. I'm not interested in the cause. I'm interested in a solution. So I think we can try to be realistic. We can try to be helpful, and I'll get to that when I address the question that was raised about Chad. And we can rally certain international partners to be supportive. But it's important ultimately that the key leadership in the North and the South and in Darfur take ownership of solutions. So we will continue to be supportive, to try to help, to try to urge, but we won't try to impose a roadmap because it's not ours to impose. Second, on the question of the bilateral talks with the government of national unity, which have been suspended. What we have done, and there was an approach made to us by Foreign Minister Deng Alor, a member of the SPLM, in behalf of the government of national unity, about whether asking us to engage in bilateral talks dealing with a range of issues. We agreed to do so. Secretary Rice pointed out as an example a long relationship we'd had with Libya, where they were, if you will, in the penalty box. They made substantial and fundamental changes, both with respect to weapons of mass destruction and terror, and the relationship changed. We have said there's a long and difficult road that would have to be traveled for any fundamental change, and we've tried to outline those and discuss a variety of issues with them. So that goes to the bilateral talks. With respect to the Chad influence, as I noted, the bleed between Chad and Sudan is acute. Part of it is the difficulty between the leadership of the two countries. Part of it is entrepreneurs in both countries taking advantage of episodic patrons in one country or the other to advance their own political ambitions. It's been destructive. It's created humanitarian suffering. The United States did take a position when the GEM got to Omdurman, condemning that assault. We also have had discussions in capitals and with some of the patrons of Chad about the necessity to curb the support for GEM, and we've also had full exchanges with the government of Sudan about its support for Chadian rebels. UN needs to be proactive in full mandate. I just refer anyone who actually has an interest. Apparently, the SRSG for UNMISS, Mr. Kazi, made a statement this morning condemning my condemnation of their lack of action, which I think speaks eloquently for their commitment to protect civilians. There has to be a change in mindset, and I think the Security Council yesterday was more forward-leaning. I think they will be today when they get the report from the Security Council mission. The French and British headed up that mission, and they're giving a report to the Security Council this morning. I think there'll be recalibration. I certainly hope so. It's needed. Otherwise, we should assess why we're giving the type of financial support we are giving to these peacekeeping. With respect to UNAMID, there has been some progress if it's providing patrols between 7 and 10 o'clock in the morning up to 3 kilometers outside of camps to curb the violence that's occurring against women going out to get wood, if it's some policing that's had an impact. There has been some progress, but it's insufficient. Again, part of that is not only encouraging them, but we need more boots on the ground in an area the size of France. With respect to Avier, what's next? Again, at least my view, unless the United States or somebody else makes a decision to send troops on the ground, or unless one or the other side decides it's in their interest to reignite warfare, it's probably better to have some practical political considerations going in and not holding on to things that have failed. And so on Abyei, what's next? I hope, with any who want to be helpful, if it's Norwegians who are providing oil expertise to the parties as they deal with the oil revenue issue with the United States, is under what's realistic in the current situation, how do you move forward? How do you let go of some of that history that's so abundant you can't digest it in order to try to go forward? How do you go beyond supporting a cause and finding your way to a solution And part of that is accepting that you won't get 100%, but that your interest in peace and a sustainable resolution and protecting civilians, so the type of humanitarian suffering that happened just weeks ago to 50,000 people in Abyei doesn't repeat itself. So I think the next step with Abyei are tough decisions that neither party was willing to make when the crisis was acute. I'm not sure now that it's cooled a little bit, they'll be more anxious and pragmatic about going forward, but that's what's necessary. And unless there is a better resolution on Abyei, a more sustainable resolution on Abyei, as opposed to keeping going back and saying the ABC wasn't an arbitration, we won, goddamn it, we're going to get 100% or nothing, then you're going to get nothing, then you're going to feel good for a moment, but you're not serving your people or the long-term interests of Sudan. At the same time, there needs to be an equitable solution. There's not moral equivalency, but the fact is pragmatic recognition of interests, with both sides having decided at this point they do not want to go back to war, is doable. Any deal where the issue is money is doable, but in the end, the parties have to accept ownership. All we can do is provide information, provide suggestions, provide encouragement, and help rally international support to ensure that the decision is less likely to be abridged in spite of the history of a trail of broken promises.
Alex, would you care to offer some comments?
Let me be very brief. For years and years, I used to write these reports saying, you know, the Sudan government must do A, B, C, D all the way down, you know, these sort of laundry lists, which frankly I think now are almost complete waste of paper. I mean, the key, the instrument the Sudan government has that it uses to run the country is money. That money is being used primarily, as I see it, to buy the loyalty of elites at the center and in the provinces. If there's plenty of money around, with the price of oil being high, if a significant portion of that money were to go to the people's issues, and if the Sudan government were to be much more sensitive to the basic concerns for human dignity of the peoples of the peripheries, if the president were to make an apology, if the president were to provide a fund for compensation that were locally controlled in these places, if the funds that were promised, for example, in the Darfur peace agreement for reconstruction and building of schools and clinics and services, if those were actually to be provided, I think that would actually go a long way to making a difference.
Andrew.
Let me endorse Alex's last statement, but add something very important. The quality of the oil in the eastern oil fields is very poor. It's comparable to the Venezuelan oil in terms of its quality. It's full of sulfur and a lot of other residue in it. The only country that has the technology to efficiently refine that is the United States, and we cannot sell it to them because of the sanctions regime, which is very powerful, and it is being enforced. They badly want that technology. The Chinese oil refinery breaks down all the time because the stuff is so bad. In fact, the way they're dealing with it is they're mixing the good oil from the western oil fields with the bad oil from the eastern oil so that the bulk of it won't be so bad. The Chinese refineries and Indian refineries that get this oil, the bad oil, they have problems back home refining. We are the only ones that have. Why do you think Chavez still sends all his oil to the United States? Because we have special refineries built just to refine this. The estimates are, from competent sources, that the Sudanese government could increase between 30% and 40% their oil revenues if oil stayed the same in price by getting the American technology. So if we made a deal with them to do, and I don't trust them to carry the deal out, I'm very suspicious, but if the deal were there, they wouldn't even have to take any of the existing oil revenues. They're not getting the international rate now for this oil. They're getting way a very depressed figure for their barrels. I don't remember. The last time I looked, it was $35 a barrel. Not $130, $35 a barrel. It's probably gone up, but it's nowhere near what the international price is. They would like to have deals with the West, with us in particular, to sell oil with this technology. So they could get more revenue to distribute in the periphery of the country, which is living in the Stone Age in many areas, while the center of the country looks like the Gulf states. That's what's causing a lot of this resentment, is the people are living on $200 a year in Darfur and Kordofan in the northern province, and the Red Sea province looks like the moon. It's worse than Darfur, worse than Darfur. Among the poorest areas I've ever seen anywhere in the world. There's no development going on there. If they dealt with these issues in a constructive way, and not just through rhetoric and baloney, the dissolution of the country would be diminished, and the risk of that happening would be diminished. I don't think they're going to do it, but they wouldn't even have to spend any of the money they spend in Khartoum if they would make these deals in a way that all of us could trust.
Vanessa, did you have any comment?
I was going to say that today we've heard a little bit about moral outrage, and we've heard a lot about practical solutions. These two things are not mutually exclusive. Be morally outraged if you want. If that's what motivates you, that's fine. But that doesn't mean that practical solutions aren't a natural result of that as well. And I agree very much with the rest of the panel that we need practical solutions. And those practical solutions, and particularly on issues such as Abyei, which I spoke about, it means a package of solutions. It doesn't just mean arbitration. It doesn't just mean implementation of the Abyei protocol. It means other solutions, which don't even necessarily have to be inconsistent with the protocol or the CPA or the new Abyei roadmap. They could, in fact, build upon those agreements and enhance those agreements and do just as Andrew Nocio has said, really try to address the various interests of the parties. That means a multifaceted solution with multi-stakeholders. It's not just the NCP. It's not just the government of Sudan. It's not just the SPLM. It's neighboring countries. It's Warap State. It's Southern Kordofan who recognize the Abyei residents as citizens of those. It is the Miseria. It is the Nakhdinka. And it's not just the Miseria and Nakhdinka. It's all the other individuals from Bahr Ghazal and Unity who also seasonally migrate through that area, who depend on that area. So we need a multifaceted solution, and we need the international community. Probably no one state, I agree with Nacio, can do this, but it doesn't mean that together the international community can't make a dent. And a multifaceted solution could involve the international community saying to the local parties on the ground in Abyei, what are you concerned about? You need us to bore some more water holes so you don't have to migrate as much? Are you interested in different economic initiatives that won't disrupt your traditional and cultural and social organizations? What are they? How can we help? How can we release those kinds of tensions? So we do need a multifaceted solution with multi-stakeholders. And in terms of overall policy, debate if you want carrots and sticks. I, for one thing, carrots and sticks both work. You know, carrots on all sides, and if your sticks aren't working and they seem more like twigs, well, maybe you need to reevaluate what your sticks are as well. And I think I'll just leave it there.
Thank you. We're going to do another round of quick questions. I'm hoping, Rich, Ambassador Williamson, if you can comment a bit on China and on the Gulf states. I know we had a recent strong statement from President Hu Jintao, I believe at the end of last week, to Taha. During his visit, are we going to see some kind of accelerated deployment of UNAMID? Are the Chinese being helpful? Are they not doing enough? And on the Gulf state piece, we've had all these news reports of rather massive prospective investments in the north on food production, and which shows a sort of certain confidence, at least at that level, in terms of making some major commitments into the north on developmental grounds, commercially, looking into the future. David?
Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Dave Mazursky, currently unaffiliated. Two quick questions for
One question.
One quick question for Special Envoy Williamson.
Not two parts. One question.
With the caveat. How about that? The first is on the discussions around residency. If you can clarify if there's some agreement, at least on the parameters on that administration. Is there agreement it will be an Al-Dinka administration, or is there discussion about Dinka Miseria? And related to that, what has been the reaction of the Miseria to this latest Abyei agreement, and were they represented in any way in these discussions?
Thank you.
Hamad Abdeldaim with the Save Darfur Coalition. This is for Professor Natsios. I was hoping you could elaborate on how a more political ICC, one that doesn't pursue evidence it has, will make things any better, will bring us any closer to a political resolution. And on the oil, I believe the Japanese have the same technology. They've been refining Indonesian oil for a good 10, 15 years now. The Indonesians are almost out of oil, but Japan is the other country that has that technology and is currently refining Sudanese oil.
Thank you. Next. I'll come to you.
Rob Satch from student at American University. Mr. Natsios, you mentioned the role of Chad, Libya, and Eritrea. You know, Dr. DeWall, you have written substantially and have put out other people's work that deals with that, and possibly a regional solution. So my question to both of y'all and to Ambassador Williamson, what do you see the United States' role in possibly engaging some of those neighboring states? And is any of that being done, Mr. Williamson? Are we talking to any of them? How can we exert some influence there?
Thank you.
I'm Laura Chin from the Office of Transition Initiatives at USAID. And a number of you have commented on the regional nature of the crisis and the role of the neighbors in some ways perpetuating the crisis, the many crises. I wonder if any of you see a role for Joseph Kony in all of this, obviously not a constructive role, but whether you see Joseph Kony as sort of a potential wild card that could...
Not a potential wild card.
or how you think that might play out.
Your question is, does Kony's presence figure in the stability of the South?
Or the instability of the South, and is there a possibility that Joseph Kony could substantially exacerbate the problem?
Okay. Rich, do you want to lead off?
I would let the other end start.
Start down. Andrew, do you want to weigh in?
I'm getting confused with these questions now. But in terms of the neighbors, I don't want to go into all the details because if I do, people will stop talking to me. And I, even though I'm not a diplomat anymore, I do like to talk to people, find out what's going on. Let me just say that there is still our relationship with Libya has been steadily, it's not steadily, it's been improving. It's a little erratic sometimes, but it's improving. And I cultivated that relationship with Ali Traki, who's the minister for Africa. He's at the level of the foreign minister, but he's in charge of Africa, former foreign minister. And I found the Libyans increasingly helpful, at least in our negotiations. And so there were issues, and there's still issues. It's a little difficult for us to cultivate the Eritrean relationship, given we are, well, I can say because I'm not an, I'm basically at war with them in Somalia. So it's a little difficult for us to influence them. I actually wanted to try to do something, and I realized that would have caused a little bit of conniption fits in the city, so I didn't do it. So there are limitations because there are other equities the United States has in policy, which are very important, very substantial. So I think our influence is substantial with Chad and with Libya and certainly with Egypt. It's a little less so, a lot less so with Eritrea at this point. I think Kony is a spent force in terms of influencing it. My impression is that the Sudanese government has not, so far, played the Kony card and started arming him again, but maybe they are. I mean, some Southerners have told me they're doing that. I never saw evidence of it. But that doesn't mean they're not doing it. They did it during the war for 20 years, as you know. They stopped doing it when the peace agreement was signed. I think Kony is resisting this because he doesn't want to go to The Hague. That's what this is all about. And given what the people have gone through, not just in northern Uganda, but in western Equatoria, I mean, the atrocities have been committed in the Congo. I mean, terrible stuff he's done. I think getting this done is important. I remember the last question. What could they do? Okay, I should say this probably publicly, but I will. The fear of the ICC is if they look like they are using justice as a part of a diplomatic settlement, then they will be not taken seriously as a judicial body. Now, I did point out to them, and this has been done, I mean, by many other people, that under common law tradition, which is of course the Anglo-Saxon, British, American, Canadian, you know, English-speaking tradition of law, we do negotiated settlements all the time. You cooperate and you get your sentence reduced. This is apparently, and I'm not a lawyer, but I did not realize this, this is a Napoleonic Code protocol. And you do not do plea bargaining in Napoleonic Code systems. Apparently, the evidence is from stuff that was in the news media is that Mr. Ocampo was speaking publicly in a very cooperative way prior to the last 6 months. About trying to resolve some of these settlements, some of these conflicts, not just Sudan, not even just Kony, but other ones as well, was sort of understanding the politics of a peace settlement. That was seen, apparently, by career people within the ICC and the European Union as undermining the ICC. I have to say, I don't know who to talk to. I'm not in that position anymore. But I don't think the position of stonewalling this issue for the ICC is constructive, not just in Sudan, but with Kony, with Mugabe, and with lots of other conflicts. Does that mean we should have impunity? No. But it does mean that constantly indicting everybody, especially when you're never going to never prosecute them, I don't know what the purpose of that is. It just makes people more paranoid. It means they'll never leave office. I want these people to leave office all these conflicts. And they're not going to do it if they think they're about to get arrested.
Alex, would you like to offer some comments on the ICC, on Masuria, on any of the other issues that were raised?
On the ICC, I'm gravely concerned that the strategy of the prosecutor is one that goes beyond any reasonable expectation of evidence. I haven't seen his evidence, obviously, but one only has to read what he said to the Security Council to have a very clear idea of what he has in mind. And it has completely unknowable political consequences. His strategy in Argentina was the junta had handed over power. He didn't prosecute the head of state who handed over power. He prosecuted his predecessors. So the order was, you know, first you hand over power, then, you know, if you're unlucky, then you get prosecuted. And he went for the junior ones, then went up the role, up the hierarchy. He doesn't have the junior ones. He wants the junior ones, but he hasn't got them. And to go up in those circumstances with the Sudan government in office, to the extent of saying essentially that the entire Sudan government is a criminal enterprise, I don't know what implications this has for the U.S. government, but for the governments that are state parties to the ICC, I think in many cases it would be hard for them to have embassies, to have development cooperation programs. It may be hard for them to cooperate with peacekeeping forces because they couldn't sit at the same table with a military officer who answers to somebody who has been indicted. It would probably put a freeze on all, the US is a different case, but virtually all Western cooperation in the implementation of the CPA. That's the most likely implication. And I think that would need to be taken very, very seriously.
Thank you. Vanessa, do you want to offer any comments? And we're going to come back to Ambassador Williamson to close with a series of comments on these questions. Vanessa?
I would think I would just narrowly answer the issue of the residency. The residency or the resident requirement, shall we say, is supposed to be defined by the Abyei boundary, the Abyei Referendum Commission, which obviously isn't established. What is a resident? And so it is interesting that the Abyei roadmap says that the chief administrator and the deputy chief should come from the residents. So who are the residents, especially when so many have been IDPs for so long? And it says that the government itself should be representative and inclusive of all the residents of the area. The best answer I can give you is one of the things to look at is the Vienna, you know, the Venice Commission that speaks a lot to issues of elections and referendums. They most simply define resident as a habitual residence. So what does that mean? I mean, logically, the plain mean is it does not mean those who seasonally migrate through. However, that said, you know, if we're looking at practical solutions, obviously any government that is eventually established in Abyei through eventually elections, and then also not just through elections, but through compromises of the parties to keep the area stable, will have to include some representation of non-residents, of those who seasonally migrate, whether it's they're given observer status, whether they're given reserve seats, or whether they whether a separate commission in the government is established to protect, you know, minority rights or rights of seasonally migrate. I think an accommodation has to be there. But it's those who habitually reside. I think that's what the Abyei Referendum Commission will eventually come up with.
Great. Thank you very much. We're getting to the conclusion here, so I'd like to ask Ambassador Williamson to offer the final comments on some of the questions that have been put on the table.
Thanks very much. And before I do, let me just thank Dave from USIP and Steve from CSIS for organizing this and allowing me to participate. First, with respect to the regional solution, I just echo what others have said. Chad, Eritrea, and Libya have a disproportionate role, but also other countries have a strong interest. There's great fear of a meltdown that will have a destabilizing effect that will spread. And yes, we're struggling to try to engage them in a practical ways. To Dave Mazursky, who is great Sudan expert. It's good to see you again. On the administration, part of it is not an explicit agreement with respect to Dinka. Part of the full and frank exchange going on now on the chief administrator and deputy chief administrator deals with some of the ethnic components. I'd say to date, the SPLM has shown a maturity in trying to work through this issue, and hopefully the NCP will see it in their interest also to show a similar maturity so that there can be an agreement on both those posts, of which I think, at least as of late yesterday, there had not been a resolution, but I think there's been some progress. On the Gulf states are big players. There are many Sudanese who moved to Saudi Arabia for a period of time, send money back. As we've closed some of the financial avenues in the United States and Europe, more has flowed through the Gulf states as well as some Asian states. They have traditionally made investments. Efforts are being made to have them also be more proactively constructive. They're not adverse to that, but what we might want to see may overreach what they feel is in their national interests. With respect to China, like others, I was very pleased to see that the issue was raised with Vice President Taha. I think, unlike other political environments, we can assume there was probably a 1,000-degree inflation in what was publicly reported was said versus what was actually said in private. But the very fact it was raised has some benefit. China has a huge economic stake in Sudan. It gets 6% of its imported oil from Sudan. It's driven very heavily in its foreign policy on resource extraction. We see that in Africa, in Angola, Nigeria, Sudan, and elsewhere, not only oil but other natural resources. We see that in their relationship with Iran and elsewhere. Very understandable because of their need to push the economic growth inland, the same reason they're building 30 nuclear facilities. Having understood all that, they also, to cite Bob Zelik, need to be responsible stakeholders, so we're hopeful they might be a little bit more forward-leaning and constructive because of their position. Finally, let me just go back more generally, if I can, and I apologize, but I want to reiterate, I think in my own assignment for the President's desire to alleviate the humanitarian suffering, keep the CPA together, make progress in Darfur is deep and genuine. In my job, I think I have to be realistic and tough-minded and practical. But the U.S. has interests because it's in our interest to keep stability in Eastern Africa. As has been referenced, we already have the situation in Somalia. We have a less secure situation in Kenya after the election. The U.S. own interests are in a stable Eastern Africa. Also, given Eastern Africa's history as a home for Osama bin Laden and other activities, we have an interest because of the effort to combat global terrorist networks. But finally, our values have to animate our foreign policy. And if there's one value that we should be enshrining since World War II, in which we've failed multiple times and has been in display in Sudan, is our pledge of never again. And while we have not prevented mass ethnic cleansing and genocide in Darfur, I think we do have a moral obligation to do better, to be impatient, and to push the envelope to try to get some sort of sustainable situation. Thank you.
Steve, let me just seize the microphone for a final thanks to our audience for being so attentive and tolerant of our difficult physical conditions today. And thanks to you, Steve, and to the panel for a magnificent 2 hours of discussion of Sudan. Thank you. Thank you.